From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The U.S. military is likely to begin its retaliation against the attacks of September 11th with an assault that is fast and brutal, reports Mark Bowden in the Philadelphia Inquirer. On today's Fresh Air, we'll discuss what Bowden has learned from his sources in the military and intelligence communities. He's the author of the bestseller Black Hawk Down about the U.S. mission in Somalia. Hollywood studios are postponing the release of several films dealing with terrorism. One of them, Collateral Damage, stars Arnold Schwarzenegger as a fireman whose family is killed by terrorists. We'll talk with the film's director, Andrew Davis. And we remember violinist Isaac Stern. He died Saturday at the age of 81. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The United States war against terrorism will involve the military's special forces. My guest Mark Bowden wrote about the special forces in his bestseller Black Hawk Down, about the day-long battle when U.S. forces landed in Mogadishu, Somalia, in 1993. Bowden wrote about terrorism in his book Killing Pablo, about the hunt for Pablo Escobar and the leaders of Colombia's Medellin cocaine cartel. Bowden also writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer and has been covering how America's military retaliation is likely to begin. We called Bowden earlier today at his home in suburban Philadelphia. Many Americans, in spite of their grief and anger over the attacks of September 11th, are worried that our retaliation will kill many civilians. Bowden thinks our weapons are sophisticated enough to keep damage to a minimum.
I think, for instance, when the United States bombed in Belgrade, to end the Serb aggression in Kosovo, you didn't see much of an outcry over civilian casualties, in part because I think they were minimal. It used to be that, like in World War II, when the United States bombed the Nazi Germany, they would basically fly hundreds of bombers over a city and open the doors at the bottom of these bombers and literally just spew bombs out the bottom and throw them down at the ground. And so in order to sort of knock out a power plant, you might have to drop 2,000 bombs, many of which hit in the near vicinity but nowhere near the target. We're fortunate with the arsenal that we have now of being able to target with great precision what we're going after. Obviously, there's no way to guarantee that there won't be civilians killed when that sort of thing happens, and that's why, you know, taking this step into warfare is not done lightly. But I would hope that any bombing campaign directed at the Taliban or at these terrorist organizations' bases would be aimed with great precision.
But we've been hearing that there's so little in the way of targets in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. The country is so bombed out as a result of the long war with the Soviets and then civil war afterwards. What have you been hearing about possible targets?
Well, I think it is difficult. There are possible targets. The Afghani government, the Taliban, is actually fighting a civil war at the moment. And they have an army and they have an air force. That means that they have bases, they have heavy equipment, they have planes, they have communication centers, not much, but some, and they rely upon them. And I think that even though, you know, we're not dealing with a modern state as we were in Serbia, we can make life very difficult for the Taliban. We could make it difficult for them to fight their civil war. We could make it difficult for them to continue to rule and have a hold over the country. And I do think that there are fairly well-established terrorist bases, although I suspect bin Laden and his crew have long since cleared out of them. So I think that you're right that a bombing campaign in Afghanistan is more limited than the kind of damage that could be done to a modern state. It nevertheless can bring extraordinary pressure to bear on that government and can get people moving, which I think is a situation that helps special forces in going after them.
Your sources in the military tell you this action is going to be fast and brutal. What does that mean?
Well, I think that people who have been arguing about what we're going to do in Afghanistan, I've heard a lot of discussion certainly over the last 2 weeks, seem to be under the misconception that the United States is going to invade Afghanistan and that we could be caught up in a tragic, protracted conflict, much as the Russians were. And I think the difference is that any strikes done by the United States will be, as I said, precisely targeted, will take place over a fairly short period of time. Any introduction of ground troops will probably be these elite units like Delta Force or SEALs who rely on speed and surprise in getting in and getting out as quickly as possible. And so that's the difference that I think that I'm trying to make.
Are the special forces already well-trained for the type of action they'll likely be called on to perform?
They are. They, in fact, you know, have been planning and practicing going after terrorist camps in Afghanistan in particular for several years, and they practice these things continually. That's not to say that they things don't go wrong. and that, you know, even the best trained soldiers dropped in on a on a lightning raid that has a fairly limited goal can't get pinned down, caught up in a brutal fight, captured or killed. This is very dangerous work, but I think that the men that the United States is sending to do these missions are probably the best trained, best equipped in the world.
I imagine you've met a lot of the Special Forces men because you've written about them. I can't help but wonder if they look forward to the right word, if they're anxious to go in and do this. If because they're trained, they want to go ahead and they want to go.
I think they do want to go, and I think that it's a credit to them because these are not kids. When I wrote my book, Black Hawk Down, about the Battle of Mogadishu, one of the things that I tried to capture was the kind of naive enthusiasm for war that some of the U.S. Army Rangers had prior to the big fight that happened on October 3rd, and they got their comeuppance, at least in the fact that they realized what a nightmare war was and that it's not something that anyone should look forward to. The soldiers of Delta Force, the SEALs, these are older, more experienced, more mature men. They're deeply patriotic, extremely committed to what they do. They believe that force is necessary in this world, that if the United States is going to survive and thrive as a nation in this world, we need to be able to employ force effectively. And their belief in that and their belief in themselves, I think, makes them somewhat eager when the situation calls for it to demonstrate what they're capable of.
How do the tactics of the Special Forces compare to the tactics of conventional military?
Well, conventional military relies on strength in numbers and on things like heavy air support, tanks, the whole array of conventional war-making equipment. Special Forces works in with very small units. They rely less on strength in numbers and in firepower than on violence of action, speed and surprise. They're designed to conduct very specific, small-scale kinds of operations, and they're also designed not to occupy territory or to take things over, but to get in, accomplish their mission, and get out. I think that pretty much sums it up.
Have you seen the training of Special Forces?
I have seen them carry out some of the kinds of raids they do. In fact, I wrote about in Black Hawk Down a Delta Force raid on a target house in Mogadishu, and I spent a lot of time and effort trying to imagine, on the basis of the descriptions I was given, what that was like. And I did my best in the book to describe it. When they made the movie of Black Hawk Down, which is currently in production, I was over in Morocco, and the pilots and rangers who carried out that assault, the same units at any rate, reenacted it in the streets of Mogadishu. So I have had the opportunity to actually see it, and it's so much more violent, it's so much more fast, so much more loud and intimidating than anything I had ever imagined.
In what way was it faster and louder than anything you'd imagined?
Well, I was there. I was standing on the street, when the first assault came in. The Little Bird helicopters, they're called AH-6s, literally have the assault forces riding on benches on the outside of these little helicopters. And they just, in a second, appear overhead, land on the street with people scattering, running in all directions. And before you really, it's very, very loud. It's shocking when it happens, even in this case when I knew it was going to happen because it was being done for the movie. But it was just, boom, suddenly they're there. By the time you've kind of reacted just to the noise and to the sudden appearance of them, they are already in the house arresting the people that they're after. And then in come the big helicopters, the Black Hawks, which make a lot of noise and stir up a great storm of wind. And in the midst of this sudden chaos, there's suddenly soldiers on the ground who've roped down from the helicopters. So, watching it, it makes you appreciate how hard it would be to react in any kind of offensive way against something like that, it would take time. And I think that's the purpose. They've designed these exercises so that they happen so fast and so violently that it takes their enemy at least a few minutes to figure out what to do next. And if they're good enough at it, they're sort of in and out before anyone has a chance to respond.
The movie adaptation of your book, Black Hawk Down, about our military action in Somalia is in production. You know, a lot of Hollywood movies are being put on hold right now because the tone of the movie doesn't seem to fit with the tone of the nation right now. What do you think is going to happen with Black Hawk Down? Do you think that the opposite might happen, that it might be kind of rushed into theaters more quickly because it's about the American military?
I think that there's a possibility that that could happen, but I'm also aware, because I've been talking to Jerry Bruckheimer and Ridley Scott, that they are very sensitive to not trying to exploit something as serious and important as what's going on right now. I'm actually flying out to Hollywood tomorrow to see as much of the film as there is to be seen, and I'm sure that, you know, one of the reasons they want me to do that is that they're all trying to figure out, you know, whether the film as it now stands is appropriate to the present situation. I tend to think it will be, and in particular because it depicts precisely the kind of military action that we're likely to engage in here in Afghanistan and other parts of the Middle East as we're going after these terrorist groups. So it remains to be seen. I think we're still trying to figure out exactly how it fits into this sort of remade world.
But the story in Somalia doesn't really end in victory.
It does, in the sense that the soldiers successfully carried out their mission. I mean, they were targeting two lieutenants of Mohammed Farah ID that day, and they got them, arrested them, and took them out of the city. Now, obviously, it didn't go smoothly. Things did not go as planned, and there ended up being American soldiers killed and many, many Somalis killed. But in a way, you know, I think that that's a very important message for where we are right now, because ideally we would love to think that these forces are so good at what they do that they're going to be able to carry out these missions without any Americans getting killed or hurt. What Black Hawk Down demonstrates is, to a certain extent, the inevitability of things going wrong and what it looks like when things go wrong. So in that sense, you know, I think it's probably a good cautionary tale for Americans who are really gung-ho and enthusiastic about getting into action.
My guest is Mark Bowden. He writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer and is the author of the bestseller Black Hawk Down. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Bowden. He writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer and has been reporting on our military plans. He's the author of Killing Pablo, about Pablo Escobar, and the author of the bestseller Black Hawk Down. Now, bin Laden was connected somehow to our action in Somalia. What's the connection?
Well, it's actually a very tenuous connection, Terry, because there's a tendency, I think, particularly in the press, to inflate the diabolical reputation of someone once they've been singled out as a kind of enemy of the United States. And I think that's what's happened with bin Laden and Somalia. The truth is that there were Somalis who fought in Afghanistan, and some of them maybe fought even with bin Laden. And when the United States intervened in Somalia in 1992, and certain elements in Mogadishu were opposed to that, those who were aligned with Mohammed Farah Aidid, there were, you know, I would presume that these veteran Afghan fighters were probably leaders among those who fought against UN troops and who ended up fighting against the United States. And they no doubt had some some experience in shooting at helicopters, having been fighting the Russians for a long time, so they probably loaned their expertise. But when it came right down to it, in the battle of October 3rd, 1993, what shot down the American helicopters was the fact that they were able to throw so many rocket-propelled grenades into the air. It wasn't any particularly clever technique in using those weapons or anything like that. And so I think whatever role was played by those Afghan veterans was more general and, you know, may or may not have been connected with bin Laden. The one place where bin Laden maybe did have an influence is he probably loaned money and he probably had a hand in supplying some of those weapons.
What's gone wrong? What's your understanding of why it's been so difficult for the United States, with all its intelligence, to find out where the terrorists are and root them out?
I think that the intelligence, while it's taking a beating right now and has certainly failed in a number of ways, is better than most people think that it is, that we have in fact known where people like bin Laden have been over the past 5 or 6 years from time to time. What I think is that we have lacked the will to go after these people. There's a very delicate balance in the Middle East, as anybody who spent any time there understands, between the moderate factions of sort of the moderate leaders and the fundamentalist zealots, who are feared, I think, by the moderates in those states. And even someone like Yasser Arafat tries to maintain a delicate balance in his efforts to create a Palestinian state between advocating for the interests of his people, but not angering Hamas, the extremists in their midst, because I think that his regime, the PLO, runs the risk of being toppled or displaced by these extremists, and I think that's the situation in a lot of these countries. So there was an understandable caution, or some would say timidity, on the part of the United States about doing something like going after bin Laden in Afghanistan that might upset that balance and could tip the factor in favor of the extremists. I think the attack on the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon has banished that timidity, for better or for worse.
But it is a real concern.
Certainly it's a concern, and it's, like many conflicts that the United States has entered on in its history, the outcome is uncertain. One scenario that you could easily see is that this military effort by the United States will end up throwing the Middle East into chaos and giving the Islamic extremists an excuse to recruit tens of thousands of supporters who see a holy war between the secular Christian United States, against the Muslim world, and that's a possibility. I think that it's also possible that military action by the United States could embolden the moderate Arab states and the moderate Muslims to crack down on the fundamentalists, whose fundamental disagreement with the Western world is only partly to do with the political grievances that have accumulated over the years and has much to do with just a basic opposition to our way of life.
Mark Bowden, after writing about the U.S. action in Somalia and after writing about the end of the Medellin cartel, what are your thoughts on how President Bush is approaching, to the extent that we know how he's approaching, the war on terrorism?
Well, I'm extremely impressed so far with the way that President Bush has handled this, and not just because his rhetoric has been very effective and powerful, but because more because of the restraint that he's shown. I'm particularly impressed with the way that he has reiterated again and again that this is not going to be easy, that this is not going to be fast, that it will involve casualties. One of the things that made the mission to Somalia a disaster was that the president and the Congress and the administration had done nothing to prepare the American public for the possibility of American casualties. No one had ever explained why this was even significant, why this was an important exercise, so that when we saw dead American soldiers being dragged through the streets of Mogadishu, I think everyone's reaction, in addition to horror, was, why? Why are we even there? You know, why are these lives being lost? In this case, I think the president has done an extremely good job of sort of marshaling public opinion for what could be a very costly and difficult campaign. But I think more important than any of that is I'm impressed with his emphasis on the broad nature of this attack, that it involves more than the military. It involves political, diplomatic, financial assault. I think that, frankly, those last three, the politics, the diplomacy, and the attack on the finances may ultimately prove to be the most important part of this whole exercise. So, you know, I think that this has to be done. I certainly understand the list of political grievances that have created hostility toward the United States and the Middle East, but I do believe that there are these, at the core of this hatred of the United States is a small group of zealots who oppose basically what we stand for as a country, which is a separation of church and state and the modern society that we have. And I think we really are, in a certain sense, being called upon to defend our way of life.
And Mark Bowden, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Terry. My pleasure.
Mark Bowden writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's the author of the best-selling book Black Hawk Down and of Killing Pablo. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the National Endowment for the Arts. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Anchor Books, paperback publishers of the new novel by Margaret Atwood, The Blind Assassin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember violinist Isaac Stern. He died Saturday at the age of 81. Hollywood studios have postponed the release of several action films about terrorism. We'll talk with Andrew Davis, director of one of those films, Collateral Damage, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Terrorism is a popular subject for Hollywood action films, but after the attacks of September 11th, movie studios have delayed the release of several films with terrorist plots. On September 12th, Warner Brothers Pictures postponed the October 5th release of Collateral Damage, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger as a firefighter whose family is killed in a terrorist attack. My guest, Andrew Davis, is the director of Collateral Damage. He's best known for his thrillers and action movies such as The Fugitive, A Perfect Murder, Code of Silence, starring Chuck Norris, and the Steven Seagal movies Under Siege and Above the Law. We called Andrew Davis and asked him first about the threat against Hollywood. Studios were put on alert last Thursday after the FBI warned of an uncorroborated but credible threat that a film studio in California could be the target of a terrorist bombing in retaliation for any bombing attacks by the U.S. in Afghanistan. I asked how he reacted when he first heard the threat.
I thought first that it might be something that was created by somebody in Los Angeles. It had nothing to do with anything. And then I also thought that it's very viable in terms of Hollywood being an image maker for the world and a focal point for media attention and a way to get lots of attention for anybody's cause.
What else do you think the message might be?
Well, I think Hollywood movies are a symbol of America all over the world, and I think it's like the trade towers might be images of American power and business. So does Hollywood become a part of that?
Are you changing the way you're behaving in the light of that threat, what you're doing, where you're doing it?
My life is going to continue on. I'm preparing another movie, and it doesn't relate to anything that these issues involve. And I'm just concerned about the whole world right now, not so much about myself. I'm just concerned that this event be able to be turned into something positive rather than negative, meaning that this event, because of its great tragic consequences, will allow us to learn to get along with each other in a way we've never thought about before.
Yeah, in the meantime, it looks like the opposite might happen.
Well, I think that's our duty right now as communicators and filmmakers, is to say, how did we get here and how are we going to get out of this? You know, one of the problems of drama and making entertainment is that thrillers, for example, are always based upon the quality of the bad guys. And, when the Cold War ended, everybody was scrambling around to try to find the, quote, bad guys. And maybe we need to make movies where we show how people could live together, and our challenge would be to make dramatic and entertaining and involving stories that show how we might get to a place of kind of nirvana, you know? Maybe I'm a dreamer, but I'd like to believe that I could make movies that show people how we could live together.
Meanwhile, you've had to pull Collateral Damage, your new movie starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. What's in the movie that made you think it should be postponed?
Well, the imagery of the movie is scarily close to the events that happened in New York last week. I mean, not to the, of course, on the scale. But the story is about a fireman. The opening scene of the movie is Arnold saving lives in a collapsing building. And he goes home to his wife and child and proceeds to hear that his wife thinks that his kid should go to the doctor. He's got a sore throat, and Arnold's going to meet them down in a large urban area to pick the child up from the pediatrician. And as he gets out of his truck to go forward, a bomb goes off. So the imagery is so close to what happened. It's like China Syndrome in a way. My friend Michael Gray wrote China Syndrome. And the events of that Three Mile Island accident happening with the opening of the movie were very similar. And basically, it's the story of the grief and loss of a fireman dealing with his family's dying and what he has to go through to try to collect his life. And in frustration, he goes after the man who did it.
Who are the terrorists in the movie?
Well, the story involves Colombia and our involvement in Colombia. It does not involve the Middle East at all. It's a totally different area. And my interest in making this movie was to basically try to prevent violence, not to use violence as entertainment. My goal here was to say something is going on in Colombia that looks very scary to me. And we better think about what we're getting involved in down here. I did a film in Colombia many, many years ago as a young cameraman. And I worked in Bogota and in the outskirts of Bogota. And I fell in love with the country. And the events of the last 20 years in Colombia have just made me very, very sad. And we as a people are, I don't think, are really aware of what's happening down there. So my goals of making Collateral Damage as a filmmaker were to say, let's wave a flag here and say, please, let's not get involved in a war that's going to cause more innocent people to get killed. Colin Powell was on his way to Bogota when he turned around.
I'm wondering, from the way you described the movie, if maybe this isn't an argument for releasing it now, if it speaks to the moment.
Well, I think it's inappropriate for people to go through the emotional wrenching that that Arnold as a character goes through in the movie. I mean, this movie is much more significant this week than it was 10 days ago. And it has a kind of reverberation emotionally and politically, and that it didn't have before these events.
After September 11th, was everybody involved in the film unanimous that you should postpone the release of it, or was there a debate inside?
Oh, I think it was very unanimous. I think people didn't know what to think. I mean, this is such a unique happening, a tragedy. You know, the United States has never dealt with anything like this on their own soil before. And because of that, people had no idea what the reaction would be. And I think that the fact that the title talks about innocent people being killed, collateral damage is a term that's been used for years now. It was used in relation to Yugoslavia and Bosnia, in the Middle East, and all over the world this term has been used in terms of innocent people being caught in the middle of terrorist acts or acts of war. And I think that it was just too close to home to release this movie right now. I think that the movie will be embraced in a way that will give it great significance when it's finally in the theaters. And I think that it'll have a significance and importance and a humanity to it, because this is not a revenge movie in the sense that here's the good guy, here's the bad guy, let's go get him. This is a story about a fireman who goes on a journey to find justice for his wife and son's death, and realizes that he may be coming the man he's chasing. A man who saves lives may be coming a man who takes lives.
Do you know when the movie will be released?
No, I don't. And this is a decision that's beyond me. The decision will be made by Warner Brothers, and I'm sure it won't be for several months.
How has September 11th affected the kinds of movies you want to make compared to, say, Joe Lieberman going to Hollywood and saying you should be toning down the violence?
I think that it reinforces the idea that images contain powerful messages for people. And we have a responsibility with the imagery we put out there, both in terms of putting ideas in people's minds that may be played out in ways that hurt other people. And we have a responsibility to our own selves and our children to portray images that can give them some way to lead their lives without being paranoid, without being racist, without being in a world where everybody is absolutely at war with each other and afraid to talk to each other.
Do you think it's conceivable that certain movies or certain types of movies have actually even influenced the terrorists?
I don't know. You know, this question came like the giant James Bond movies. It was always a joke that the intelligence services of the world would see a James Bond movie and get an idea and say, hey, we ought to go make that. That's pretty cool, you know. It's the old chicken and egg situation. Does life imitate art? Does art imitate life? Certainly, the idea of wars and tragedy and people being mad at each other has been a part of drama forever. And it will continue to be a part of drama. And the politics and history have become a part of entertainment because that's what our lives are about. It's relevant to people. They can relate to what the issues are. Think of all the movies that are made after Vietnam, of all stripes. And I think this subject is not going to go away. It's going to be part of our history, our literature, our entertainment for 100 years and or more. And, you know, there will be a period movie made about this time 100 years from now. And so I don't think it's going to go away. I think it's a question of what are the sensitive issues that are in front of us right now. Will it affect the way people play this out, the way they dramatize it, the point of view they take? And there will be all kinds of points of views made in terms of dramatic entertainment about this subject.
My guest is film director Andrew Davis. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Andrew Davis. The release of his new movie, Collateral Damage, has been postponed. It stars Arnold Schwarzenegger as a fireman whose family is killed in a terrorist attack. You know, as the director of several thrillers, you've had to make things blow up. What was it like when you saw on television the World Trade Center blowing up? I mean, this is the kind of image that a lot of people in Hollywood have created artificially for the movies. And there was, like, the real thing live on TV.
Well, I reacted to it like any other human being in America did. You know, I was just, it was mind-boggling. And I think the fact that I was watching it on a television, I was so removed from everything, gives that kind of veneer to it of desensitizing it again. It was the faces of those people running away and the firemen walking around in a daze that we saw afterwards that really was the most emotional part for me.
Do you think that September 11th is going to change the kind of movies you want to make? Will you want more explosions in your movies, even if there is a larger political or social message behind the explosion?
Well, first of all, you know, my first movie was a very gentle movie about a young musician growing up in Chicago, and it was a film called Stony Island about, you know, my brother growing up on the South Side as the last white kid on the block making it in a black neighborhood as a young musician, and that's the film that launched my career as a director. And then I was offered a picture called Code of Silence, a police thriller, and it made a lot of money, and that's how I got into the action world. I'm starting a film called Holes, based upon an award-winning book by Lewis Sacker, a young people's book. It's a very layered, sensitive story about a kid in a reform school in Texas, and I'm looking forward to doing that very much. I have several other projects that basically are very optimistic and hopeful kinds of movies that I was planning to do before Collateral Damage was done. So I would like to be able to make movies that families can come to. I think the movies that deal with getting away from darkness and tragedy and pain are things that I would love to be a part of. They're hard to make. They're hard to make them interesting. They're hard to make them dramatic. They're hard to make them funny. And yet that's the challenge for us, is to find a way to bring ourselves together by going to this, you know, the theaters of America are the last public arenas where people sit in the dark and think about something. And I hope that we can have an assembly of people going to movies where they think about what life could be like.
Why are the films that you're talking about more difficult to make and to keep interesting than thrillers or action films?
Well, it's interesting. It's like when you make a thriller, or you make something that involves fear and danger, that film travels around the world very easily. What's funny to the German people or to the Thai people or to the American people is not the same thing all the time. So we're making global movies these days. So when you make a movie that somebody can understand all over the world, sometimes you come back to, people can relate to the story, the unjustly accused man being chased. That's a very simple storyline. That's a very clear storyline. The subtlety of certain types of comedies just doesn't translate.
During World War II, I think movies were very popular. There were movies that were just kind of entertainments to take your mind off the war, but there were also movies about the war and to boost morale.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been thinking about that, about the kind of movies that seemed to work in the past?
Well, I was born in 1946. My father came back as a sergeant from Normandy, and I was born. So I was a little young when that all happened, but I certainly understood the role of the studios later on in the war effort and in creating images that were part of the war effort. I'm sure that in a second, the studios, if the government wanted them to, would participate in supporting whatever the efforts were that was in the interest of the American people. At the same time, I think that everybody is rethinking what it is we're going to do. And, you know, it seems like there's no question that people are going to support what the government feels is proper to do in terms of retaliating or finding out who did this. And at the same time, I think all kinds of new questions are going to be asked. And Hollywood is an amalgam of America. There are going to be people who support whatever the government wants to do, and there are going to be people who question it in the sense that, are we getting ourselves deeper involved in something that we don't understand? Are more innocent people going to be hurt? And does this play into the hands of the people who did this, which makes us more the enemy and more the monster?
Andrew Davis, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Davis is the director of Collateral Damage. Its October 5th release has been postponed. The great violinist Isaac Stern died of heart failure Saturday at the age of 81. He had toured around the world performing chamber music as well as performing with orchestras. He performed more than 200 times in Carnegie Hall and helped save the hall from destruction when there were plans to build office towers in its place. The main hall was named after him in 1997. We're going to hear excerpts of two interviews with Isaac Stern. Our first was recorded in 1988. He told me he was born in Russia and moved to San Francisco with his family when he was 10 months old.
You know, I'm sitting here thinking, how many Jewish families, how many Jewish parents have said to their children, when you grow up, you should be an Isaac Stern or a Yasha Heifetz or a Yehudi Menuhin. What is it between Jewish musicians and violins? There's been so many. There's this history of Jewish violinists.
It seems to be a history of Jewish violinists. It's a recent one. It only occurred really in great numbers from the late 19th and the early part of the 20th century. There are now a whole other group of young people coming in as well. As you know, there are many, many gifted people from all over because music has become a kind of passport into authenticity of self for nations, for people, and for individuals. It was an obvious outlet as Jews began to get out of the ghetto and out of the shtetl life in Europe, and as they had been barred from so many normal areas of education, training, and in other endeavors, it turned out that playing an instrument, which was a part, not necessarily the major part of their cultural life, but there was music in their ceremonies, in their happy moments, and the sad moments, and in the official moments, that an instrument which they had a natural affinity for, as have many people, Hungarians, Germans, French, English, many, but for Jews it was literally a passport.
You know, just last night I was watching the documentary about your trip to China from Mao to Mozart. It's on video now. And there's a very nice moment in which you're telling one of the very young students, you're suggesting to her that she sing the passage that she just played, because she played it very stiffly, or comparatively stiffly. And then she sang it, and she sang it beautifully, and you said you really have to sing the music that you're playing so that you get that kind of naturalness in your sound. Was that advice that one of your teachers gave you?
No, I think it's something that one learns instinctively about music as you go along. It's a little bit like what people have asked me many times about a man who influenced me very much in my life later on, when I was 30, in 1950, Pablo Casals, who was an extraordinary musician, an extraordinary human being, a unique human being in a way. And how to explain what Casals was, and this has been a part of my ethic, I think, since I began to think about music. Casals would take you to a wall and open a door and show you the most incredible garden filled with the most exotic, most colorful plants in full bloom with every color imaginable and every cross-pollinization imaginable and full of scent and beauty. And he would show you this garden. Now, how far you walked into that garden was your responsibility. Now, all I can do then for young people is to show them what is possible and make them realize that there is such a thing as beauty, that there are things which exist, and to try to show them how to reach those goals in the simplest form.
Do you take the advice that you give that student in From Mao to Mozart, and do you sing passages before you play them?
I think I do that instinctively all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
What does it get you to say?
Colors, ideas. It's you know, there's a lot. There are a lot of ways to say, you know, I love you. 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 I'm saying the same words. How many times I've said them? The same thing goes with music. Music is literally made up of notes which are simply like a roadmap. It shows you where you begin, it shows you where you have to go in between, and shows you where you're going to finish. And that's why music is a constant discovery. There are basic rules. You cannot do that which is not written. You cannot invent or tell the composer what he should have done. It is your obligation to learn what he has done, why he has done it, and then to fill it in with the greatest amount of knowledge and essentially a kind of metaphysical compassion for the wonderment that you can never find the final answer. That's what makes us musicians. There is no finite performance. It is that which makes music what the great English writer, Anand, said.
He said that's right. Many great quotes from him.
He said, you can describe music, but you can never explain it. And if you can feel touched by that unexplainability yourself and give that sense of, I hesitate to use the word divine guidance, but of a sense of humility and divinity at the same time, then you are just beginning to become a musician.
Isaac Stern recorded in 1988. We'll hear an interview recorded with him during the Gulf War after a break. This is Fresh Air. Violinist Isaac Stern died Saturday at the age of 81. His second Fresh Air interview was recorded in 1991 during the Gulf War. He had just performed in Jerusalem with the Israeli Philharmonic. The concert was interrupted by the warning of a possible Iraqi Scud missile attack. After Stern left Israel, we phoned him in Montreal to find out what happened.
We were in the middle of the second movement of the Mozart concerto, and Zubin Mehta, who was conducting, turned and stopped me in the middle of a phrase and said, I think there's a problem. And I turned around, sure enough, the man was walking on stage to make the public address announcement that an alert had just been sounded, and will everybody please put on their gas masks and stay quiet. The auditorium was sealed against a possible gas infiltration. But the orchestra had their gas masks, as did everyone. I had one that was all just off stage. And everybody left the stage, and the audience put their gas masks on, and the loudspeakers were going in Hebrew with the explanation warnings, keep your gas masks on, don't move until the all clear is sounded, and it was in Hebrew, and then in Russian, and then in English, and some Arabic, and then back again, and I could hear the people putting their gas masks on, and then there was that feeling of restiveness and tension. We didn't have our masks on because we knew there would be about 4 minutes and 50 seconds to 5 minutes until the missile actually hit. That was about the time from early warning until missile landed, and then they would go in and examine it and see whether it was a conventional or a gas warhead. So we were waiting, and apparently, while they were waiting, I could hear the audience getting more and more restive, and I thought, this is silly. They're all sitting there, looking at each other in their gas masks. The majority of them, about 80% of them, had their masks with them. 20% didn't. And I thought this was nonsense, and something should be quiet and down. So I went on stage, gestured them to be quiet, and I played some Bach, Sarabande from the D minor Partita for Vinyl Alone. And I played it, and everybody quieted down, and they listened. I must say it was one of the more bizarre moments of my life to look out at an audience and see all these gas masks in front of me. And to hear them sitting quietly in the masks and listening to Bach, which I chose deliberately because it's quiet and contemplative and has seen its share of revolutions and wars and tragedies and happinesses and joys, and the kind of reaffirmation of faith in life. And I must say that I was very moved by it's hard to find words, but I've rarely been in a situation that you had the epitome of what it means to be an artist performer, which was to feel useful and needed.
Isaac Stern recorded in 1991 during the Gulf War. He died Saturday at the age of 81. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Lost Soldiers, a novel set in present-day Vietnam by James Webb, author of Fields of Fire, from Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of She Still Haunts Me, a novel by Katie Royfe about Lewis Carroll and Alice, his muse. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Sebastian Younger on traveling with Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of the resistance movement in Afghanistan. Massoud was assassinated 2 weeks ago. Sebastian Younger is also the author of the bestseller, The Perfect Storm. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.